Welcome to the second part of Tail F and CS episode on Software Gone Wild podcast. Last week, we discussed the principles of how Tail F and CS works, the hands-on experience Bustian and Marco got with NCS, and we ended up discussing the services they implemented. Bustian started with a VPLS service and then had to settle for something way simpler, whereas Marco managed to implement a VLAN service, which looks like it's becoming a hello world of SDN. This week, let's continue our journey toward the juicy technical details of Tail F NCS and see what else they discovered.
Now that you mentioned all that other can of worms, route distinguishers, route targets, and so on, in an ideal case, you would have a pool of this, and when you would add a new customer, you would say, well, I need a route target, and I need a route distinguisher, and I need a subnet on this interface.
So all you need, let's say, just to simplify it, for every new VPN instance, you need a global unique number for RD and RT, which can be the same. So as such, you can do that through XPath. Oh, that's another thing that is available there. So XPath does provide you some functionality, or you can use those Java callbacks where, for instance, when you provision a new instance, you will have your own code, which is typically less than one page long, that will retrieve the next available number. So you can have purely locally calculated, which could be good enough, or again, maybe because of the existing environment that the service provider uses, maybe you need to allocate it from an inventory. So it depends on what the service provider wants. I would say it's enough to locally calculate it and just ensure that it's unique. Or maybe you actually have to go out, connect to an SQL server, and sort of allocate that this number is now allocated so that other systems can see, okay, this RT number is now in use.
I think we're returning to the discussion about greenfield versus brownfield deployment at this point. In most deployments, and at most customers, being service operators and carriers, this would be integrated with some of the existing systems. So you don't actually have this problem because the allocation is already there. And the part that's provided by the NCS, by the actual engine, is the single interface, the transactional-based approach, and rapid service deployment. So you move some of the complexity, some of the proprietary scripting and drivers from the OSS, from the management system, down to the NCS. So you basically simplify all of your northbound applications. The other thing is that when you are integrating this with a brownfield deployment, some of the services are already there. So what happens when you try to provision an existing service? Basically, you would have to model the service and redeploy it again through NCS. Because all the logic that we are talking about at this point is based on the premise that the service has already been provisioned by NCS from the start. Mm-hmm. So if you have your layer 3 VPNs there working, then you bring in NCS, you basically would have to populate the database, the CDB, which doesn't know anything about the services yet. And it cannot automatically gather them from the network. So you would basically have to model the service, do the top-down approach, deploy it to the devices again, populate the CDB, and then you can manage the service that has already been deployed before NCS got in the house.
Oh, so you can't just parse the data from the device.
Reverse doesn't work. That's one misconception, that even if you have a service model, let's say for your service, and the devices are already configured with that service, and sort of they have a matching configuration, but you cannot sort of take the configuration and, let's say, create service instances inside NCS. That part, let's say, if you do this kind of a migration, requires a little bit more effort that Marco just described. So it's not automatic that from the device configuration, you would be able to create service instance configurations.
So for brownfield deployment, you would have to, well, if you have some existing orchestration system, then hopefully life is good and you can just transform data from this system to the other system. But because we know that a lot of people are configuring things manually, you would have to do another configuration scraper that would take existing configuration, extract the service parameters from existing configuration, create that service in NCS, get the new configuration out of NCS and now hope that the new configuration is equal to the old one.
And you have to deploy it.
Yeah.
So it has to be correct. Basically, you're deploying and not doing anything. So in a proper migration, you're deploying something that will be already existing in a device, but now the devices are in synchronization. And this is another important thing. So out-of-band management is not allowed in this case because we maintain synchronization between NCS and endpoint devices.
Oh, with out-of-band management, you mean manual
or any other system interfering with the configuration items that are under control of NCS.
It doesn't mean that you can't have an out-of-band management interface on the box.
No, not that. Yeah, I'm saying that whatever configuration is managed on those devices, if it's within the visibility of NCS, it has to be managed through NCS.
So because it's like Highlander, there can be only one.
Exactly. So that visibility is because it ensures synchronization. So the central point of configuration becomes NCS, not the end device. So the NCS is really the one that stores the configuration. And then every time you provision something, it will check whether they're still in sync. If they're not in sync, the service instance will not be provisioned. So your transaction will fail. So if you have, let's say, a bad habit of having engineers logging into devices, doing some ad hoc configuration, that doesn't play well with NCS in place.
But at least it will fail the transaction. It will not
blindly... No damage will be done. That's true. Yeah. So, but the operator, let's say he's doing his daily job, you know, he's provisioning a new customer and of course his whatever portal he's using will fail, say that the service instance cannot be provisioned. And of course with the proper alarms, whoever is in charge of NCS will then have to go and see why.
So one the operator will open the ticket and go away and have a
coffee. There is also an alarm center inside NCS, which is not the same as what you would find in other places. So it's not very talkative. It's not like syslog. It actually, when you see an alarm there is something terribly wrong. Yeah. So you have to address it. And in this case, whoever will be in charge of NCS, if they see devices out of sync, they have to investigate why they are out of sync.
Basically, what Bostian now described is that we are always operating on the premise that the NCS has the current global view of the network. If anything is a mismatch, if something is not okay, so in the database and between the network elements, then we have a problem which needs to be solved by the operator. And one of the good side effects of this is that you could use this solution for compliance enforcing. So you could use NCS to enforce compliant configuration data. Should you want to configure services in a brownfield deployment and avoid any configuration changes in the southbound direction, there is one trick you could use, is you could comment out the lines that should be changed in the network element driver. The NCS would think that the changes are actually being committed to the network. It would populate its database. And from that point onward, you basically have a matching configuration without touching the devices themselves. So you could be, this could be a very safe migration from non-NCS network to the NCS network.
So what you're saying is if I would have to import an existing running network into NCS, I would use some configuration scraper to get the service parameters. And then I would edit the network element driver so that it wouldn't actually push the changes out to the devices. I would create all the services. The network element driver would happily think that that has been done. And then I have, hopefully, the right representation of my network in NCS configuration database.
Which is easy to check. So you can always do checks.
Which was the next question. I check that?
And let's say if someone also out-of-band changes something, then after you investigate what the reason was, you have the option to do sync too, which means that you push, that you believe that the NCS configuration version is correct, so you overwrite whatever someone has done out-of-band. Or if someone, for some legitimate reason, changed something, let's say, that is unrelated to your services, such as, I don't know, change the syslog server address, you can say sync from, and that part of the configuration will be then retrieved from the device. A problem would be if someone out-of-band, for instance, reconfigured the route target, which is part of your service. Then you have a service which is out of sync. So now, just like with migration, you would have to figure out what to do with the configuration in the NCS, and of course here, the engineer who did that didn't use the proper way, because you would have to do that through NCS, not directly on the device, because now you have basically two systems overlapping on one single service instance.
Okay, so did I understand correctly that NCS then also tracks the part of configuration that are not covered by the element drivers?
No. Whatever it covers, it has to be supported by the element driver. But the element driver, network element driver supports, I don't know, 1,000 commands. But for your services, you're just
10.
Using 10 of them.
Okay.
So if someone modifies something outside of those 10 commands, you can easily say sync from and relearn from the device. But if someone modifies something that is part of your configuration, that you're actually your service instances, then it would be preferable to actually do everything through NCS, because you will just complicate your life if you go about, you know, and just configuring directly on devices.
So let's say if you are running AppleTalk or DECnet in your network, this will not cause any issues with NCS, because hopefully they don't have DECnet in the network element driver.
I'm almost certain it's not there. And DECnet, again, is not in iOS anymore. So.
I wouldn't be so sure. It's not in iOS XR, that's for sure. But on the other hand, if you, for example, have the syslog server and the NTP server and a number of other things that are covered by the network element driver, but you don't care about them at the moment, then you have to sync them from the device so that the network element driver and NCS configuration database are happy.
Exactly. But that said, you can still use NCS also for some element management tasks. So for instance, you can create a device template, and in the device template, you can do something that you know that all of your devices should have. Again, it's not vendor agnostic, so it's different for iOS, iOS XR, Junos, and so on. But you can say all devices must have this NTP configuration, this syslog configuration. So you can create this template, and then you can easily, through one single CLI command, you can apply it to a device group. Either to all devices, to a device group, or whatever subset. So you can have, let's say, some common configurations for provider edge routers, some common configuration for core routers and such. So it even for device management, you can easily apply a template of device-specific commands onto a group of devices with one single command. So you can maintain such templates on NCS as well. You don't have to use some other
product. So you import the managed parts of the device configuration into NCS as part of the rollout process. And then later on you say, well, for the provider edge routers, I want to send a syslog server to this particular IP address, and now go and deploy that on every BE edge router.
You can create device groups. So for instance, create a device groups for every logical group. You can even create device groups on per device type basis, so that sometimes you will have very specific commands for Juno, sometimes very specific for iOS. So you can create whatever types of groups you have, which allows you to easily apply templates or configuration items to those groups. And furthermore, after 1 year, for instance, you can also do sort of a report on compliance according to those templates. So if, let's say, things were being changed and then you did sync from, so you know that people tend to do stuff just to make them work. And after 1 year, you can figure out that, I don't know, 10% of the devices are no longer compliant to your template because for whatever reason, some changes had to be made. So now you at least know which devices are not compliant. Of course, the question is, can you reapply the template? Will you break something or not? That you don't know. So that requires some additional investigation.
Okay, so coming back to the services that you created, let's forget the loopback service. Let's start with that one. How long did that one take?
Well, this was in my learning process.
Yeah, so, I know, still.
Let's say, as I mentioned, the learning curve can be quite long if you want to be able to be proficient in everything. But the actual service model, once you get the hold of, you know, those basic concepts in young modeling language, such as, you know, containers, lists, leaves, and stuff like that, and all the restrictions that you can do, you know, a thing like that can be done in minutes. So today, let's say if I had to create a loopback service, within 5 minutes, it would be up and running.
And the learning curve, if you are somewhat proficient with programming, what if at least you understand some basic concepts, it probably takes you what?
More or less the same. So one thing that we briefly touched on is that the service parameters have to be mapped to device parameters, device configuration parameters. So someone enters an IP address. Well, that IP address has to sit somewhere within the configuration for iOS, iOS XR. So you can do that kind of mapping with an XML template. Don't be scared. You don't have to do it manually. The NCS CLI allows you to easily enter native commands, and from the native commands, you get the template, and then you just replace static values with variables. So you can do that, again, for the loopback. Let's say we would have two parameters, the loopback number and the IP address, and the subnet mask, for example. So three parameters you have to, in the template, you just have to replace static values with XPath into your data model. So altogether, that's 5 minutes. If you have more complex, you can instead of this, use Java for the same kind of mapping. So you have the so-called Nauvoo object model that basically provides you the same kind of visibility into the data hierarchy as you would have with Young, with XPath, or the CLI, or even web interface. So they all follow this hierarchy of data. And even that part, you have some, there's a bunch of examples that come with NCS. So you can learn from them. There are something like 50 examples. You even have topology there, which is sort of a simplistic approach, but it gives you the idea of what can be done. Mm-hmm. So for programming, just for mapping, again, it's easy to learn, but if you want to do some fancy stuff, then you need to know Java. So you need to be able to program.
So in your very simple case, I could use the sample Cisco iOS configuration commands, and NCS would give me the XML document that corresponds to the changes I want to make. And then I take that document and I figure out where in that document the loopback interface number is hidden.
Which is simple.
Yeah, and I replace that number, which is zero, for example, with a variable.
Yeah.
And that variable is an XPath expression.
Into the Young data model.
And for people who don't know what XPath is, and I would assume that there are like two people listening to this who know what XPath is.
Well, even my knowledge is, let's say, limited to the most commonly used option. So do you know a formal definition of XPath? So it's really more or less, I would describe it as a locating and filtering option for data encoded in XML.
I think the formal definition from Princeton was that this is a language used to navigate inside XML form structures.
Oh, thank you. That's really helpful. Well, the way I would explain it is like the directory path.
It's a filter, let's say.
You start with the root and then you list the elements separated with slashes that you need to come down to the element you need, and you have the wildcards, so you can say, well, let's skip all this in the middle or whatever you wish.
So if we come back to a simple example of a loopback, let's say that my service would be in Young, I would use list because I can have multiple loopbacks, not just one. So I use the list option and I call it loopback, for example. And inside the loopback, I would have IP-address as a leaf where I would store my IP address. So to access this data, I would use /loopback/IP-address. That would be the XPath from XML to retrieve the IP address in the actual data.
And it's exactly the same thing that you would use to access a file on a Unix file system.
Very similar to the directory structure, yes, with a lot of additional functionality.
Yeah, well, there are these other options that you can go into. Like you can do the same thing on Unix with shell wildcards, if you wish.
One thing with XPath is you also get the possibility of doing some of arithmetic operations. So you can do some calculations, you can add values together as to compute two different numbers for the interface, or whatever you want, basically.
But once you see that you have hit the limit of the functionality of XPath, then go from XML config templates, you go into Java.
Which is what I prefer.
Which basically gives you unlimited power to...
So you're lazy. Instead of learning XPath, you switch to Java as soon as possible.
You can't avoid XPath.
You can't avoid it. Even in Java, you have to navigate those models. Either you have to know XPath in your head, and you have to know their structure, and then you're just using set get commands, but basically you're still navigating the same structure, so it's the same minus slashes. The reason why I opted for Java was because once you get to the multi-vendor aspect of the solution, basically, you find out that when you have your service and when your service needs to be multi-vendor, you basically have to do mappings for each vendor device type that you want to support. So XML quickly grows to very large proportions, and it's very simple to make a mistake in there. Mm-hmm. So I found it easier, and I actually saw that there's less code when you do it in Java. Plus, in Java, you have more You can write your own functions. You can do some more advanced arithmetic. You can access some of the outside systems. So I think also my feeling is that the system itself was primarily designed to use the Java Netlinks. And because there's so much power in there that you can actually do whatever you want.
So,
if I may just interject, even in the user guide it says, so why not use just templates? The problem is that when you use templates and then you're, let's say, augmenting your services, you're building your XML template grows, and suddenly you hit a roadblock when this functionality is no longer useful, now you have to go and convert your template into Java code.
Yeah.
But if you start with Java code, even just doing simple mapping of service parameters to configuration items, it can actually be less code. It can just be sort of half a page of code to do all the mapping. But if it then gradually grows, so every 6 months you provide some additional options in the service, then there is no roadblock. You just add the functionality to it.
There's also the third option, using Java plus XML templates.
Yes.
So you would basically make an XML template for each of the device
things,
each of the vendors, and then reuse that from within the Java code. So that's also.
So you don't have to build the XML double quotes by hand.
Yeah, something like that. Or you don't have to merge the XML for all the vendors into one single file. So you can just reuse several of them in small blocks, make sure they're working, and then reuse all of them from within the Java file.
So you use one template or the one XML template or the other based on the actual device that's out there.
Correct.
Okay, moving to the next slightly more complex thing that you did. How long did that VLAN stuff take?
1 week.
Oh, nice. So you invested 1 week of your time and you learned something and you solved the VLAN provisioning problem.
But the primary goal was actually I had to teach this product to a group of students. So basically it came down to me to understand how it does things, how things are implemented, how would the whole process go. And I started with Java.
Okay, coming back, how much time it would take you today to do that?
1-2 hours, something like that.
Without the documentation.
Exactly.
No, we're not talking about documentation.
Actually,
at any point.
Actually, okay, that's a good point.
Yeah, code is self-documenting. I understand that.
No, but it actually is. One thing that you do, for instance, you create your own service model. There are those additions that they have provided where you can actually, you know, if you go through the CLI and you say services, service, L3, VPN, whatever the name is, and then you use a question mark. So there is syntax help, and whatever you put there in your young model, you can provide also the help for those commands. So at every step that you use, either through a web interface or through the CLI, you can provide syntax help, because if it's just, you know, parameter A, I don't know what that is. So first give it a logical name, but then also a text description and limitations. So it is sort of self-documented if you add that kind of information to it.
Now it's time, I guess, for 30 seconds of marketing. You mentioned that you were running a training for some people. Does that mean that people can come to NIL and get TailF training if needed?
Well, the training was for now. It was for a specific customer, for a limited group of people there. But I think from the commercial aspect, we would have to check. But the knowledge is here. We are also sort of a TailF partners. There is no official course out there that people could buy and apply to. But should they need this knowledge, sure, we're here.
And they can also use you for professional services if they need to implement new services or integrate TailF with their existing systems.
Correct.
And to reach you, they just go to nil.com and explore there. And I'll insert a link or two in the show notes. Okay, end of marketing. What else did you do with TailF?
Oh, that's a tough question. Open-ended question, I don't know. I have a lot of stuff that I have a lot of ideas, which unfortunately I don't have time to do right now, so they will have to wait for a couple of months since we are now heavily involved in developing all the trainings. So first we need to teach other people and then go back to doing the fancy stuff.
One of the things I'm looking forward is to integrate with OpenStack so that we would have a virtual network function lifecycle management system, which would mean basically we would use NCS to spin up virtual machines that would support like virtual ASA, virtual F5, load balancer, or whatever. Then after the machines get created, we would configure the network functions on top of that. And once the service is no longer needed or needs to be changed, everything is done through NCS. So basically, when you change some parameters, all the underlying stuff like virtual machine resources, the actual network function configuration gets configured automatically. So you no longer need to log into every ASA, into every load balancer, into every IPS or whatever you're using in there. Basically, it's just up to you to configure some of the parameters in a northbound application, and things sort of happen automatically. And even when you decommission the service, you no longer have those virtual machines that are hanging in there, but they're powered off, and you're wondering, where did they come from? So this is what I'm looking for.
So you are planning to add another level of dynamic service provisioning behavior to NCS. What you get today is you specify the devices and then you add services on the devices. And what you plan to do is actually to go one step forward and say, well, when you add a service, let me create a device for you and let me import that device into NCS. And then let me configure that device for the service that you just requested.
Correct.
So it's really a multi-stage approach. So I would say one step back. So first you have to trigger some external system to give you the resources. And of course, when you deprovision
that's creating the device. Yeah. You have to go to.
But you actually have to take care of also, let's say, the change in cleanup functionality. So when you deprovision a service so that you don't have zombie virtual machines left over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's one algorithm that we didn't touch. It's called FastMap, which is a part of NCS. And basically, it implements three functions by using only one, by using create function. So the create process inside NCS automatically generates everything that's needed for a modification function, because a service modification basically means delete the service and create a new instance with new parameters.
But optimized. Not everything is reset.
So minimal diff is all.
So when you modify the service, internally they delete the service.
Recreate.
They create a totally new service, and then they do the diff on the configuration.
Exactly, yes.
So from the network
that's
device.
That's cool.
Yeah,
and now imagine how the delete works.
Well.
It's not hard together.
Yeah.
But from the network device perspective, all the changes that have been internally calculated inside the CDB, so inside the NCS itself, are always the minimal diff. So everything that happens is always the minimal diff. Well, that algorithm actually has a design pattern called reactive FastMap, which basically enables you to do staging inside the same transaction. Now, for the people that are comfortable with the database world or software world, you will know about ACID, atomicity, consistency, independency, and the fourth thing.
I don't know. I can't remember.
Either. So basically what we're saying is the order inside a transaction is irrelevant. So if you have a set of commands, it doesn't really matter in which order they are sent to the network. And this basically kind of breaks the functionality when you need staging. And staging is typically used in scenarios where you have your VM, which is not existing yet. So definitely the VM spin-up needs to happen first.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a pattern in there called reactive FastMap that basically enables you to do staging. So you do ordering inside a single transaction. And again, the create and the delete are implicitly drawn from that same create sequence. So basically you only need to implement the create function, which is nice.
But within that create, you still have to take care of all of the events that take place, so the subscription yourself. So it's not something that comes out of the box. You have to do the coding around it.
Yeah, you have create, brackets, begin, now you're on your own.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so let's wrap it up here. If someone wants to know more about NCS, where can they find you?
You mean in the internet space?
Yes. Or they can drive to Slovenia, obviously.
That's preferred.
Yeah, and buy you a beer
and then you
have a nice
discussion.
That
would be the preferred way, otherwise...
For people who are living on some other continent, how can they find you in the internet space?
Email would be the best choice, so will you provide the emails?
I can do that.
Yeah. Email, LinkedIn, I'm not sure if I'm on any other social media platforms. So yeah, but email, LinkedIn, those will contribute
the rest. Yeah.
Okay, so I'll insert all that contact information in the show notes. Thank you for being with me. Thank you for this insight in NCS. I hope people will find it useful.
Well, I do, so I was quite pleasantly surprised when I saw it, and I hope other people will like it as well.
Yeah, it's definitely a nice product. I love the standardization part of it. Let's hope it continues to go that way. And let's also hope that the vendors, we start our discussion with NetConf, let's hope that the vendors actually go down that path and support NetConf in a more complete manner than the state we are in today.
Okay, so let's stop at this dreamland picture of happy unicorns. You've been listening to Software Gone Wild, and if you want to subscribe to the podcast, go to podcast.ipspace.net. And on the other hand, if you want to know more about the SDN and its various variants, or you want to get training or consulting on SDN, go to sdn.ipspace.net, which will open a whole page of SDN resources, and I'm positive you'll find something for you there. And if you get totally confused and you don't know what to buy, I have a simple solution for you. It's called a subscription. It gives you access to everything we ever produced on ipspace.net and everything that we will produce within 12 months. So thank you for listening to the podcast, and don't forget, if you're using iTunes, go to iTunes and review the podcast right now. We still don't have enough reviews, and that's a shame. Thank you.